Heading into another hour with Oberon Zell, Ravenheart, A Wizard's Bestiary is his new book. He wrote a grimoire on wizardry as well. He is the headmaster of a school on wizardry, one that's taught online, and he is an authority on the art and the science of wizardry, and we'll talk about that coming up next. What can he do as a wizard that the rest of us can't do, or at least haven't learned to do? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Funnett. Oberon Zell, Ravenheart, A Wizard's Bestiary is the book. But let me pull back a little bit on this, because we were talking about the role of these wizards' beasts in magic and what the purpose of them were. So let me go to a broader question on that in that regard. We started off by talking about some of the things that you can do as a wizard, and what magical practice means as you define it. But can you ever, I mean, are there some wizards who can do the things which, you know, we've always associated with wizardry, like teleportation?
Well, teleportation, now that's a kind of a tricky one. I've never heard of anybody actually being able to do that precisely, although there are certainly examples of small levitation type stuff that have been reported, and I can't do that. I can do a bit of psychokinesis. I can do a great deal of telepathy.
Can you move? You can move objects with your mind.
Certain things, yes. I'm particularly good at flame and smoke type of stuff and cloud stuff. Weather working is one of the things that we teach, and the ability to shift the clouds a little bit in the degree of weather working is definitely a learnable skill. It can be done. And I've taught many kids and people sitting around campfires on how to move the smoke to keep it out of their eyes, you know. So that's a fairly straightforward thing. Most of these things can be taught. There's very little in the realm of magic that is that can't be just learned by many people. But it's like learning music or art. You know, there's an art to it. Now, that's the magic part of it, but wizardry isn't just magic. The word literally means wisdom. And so a wizard is a wise one, you know, and the whole function of a wizard throughout all of history, their role is to be a teacher and a mentor and a guide and a counselor. In most of the stories where wizards appear, they perform a virtually identical role of teaching the young hero what it is he needs to know before he goes off on the quest, you know, which will change everything. And yet that's what you encounter all the time in the stories. Wizards have historically, and as well in stories, been advisors to kings and royalty. One of the very first recorded wizards in all of history was Imhotep of Egypt, and he was an amazing man. He was he still comes down to us in the legend of the living mummy, because he never died, according to the stories and legends. He's among those people whose legends did not include a death, you know, exactly. So we have a few people like you know, Imhotep and Dracula and Santa Claus and Elvis Presley, you know, who never really quite died, attained immortality in that sense. But he was the first architect, the first astronomer, the first person to record medical treatises. The amazing thing about wizardry is that it's so well documented. We have the records because wizards in history tended to write down stuff, some of them prolifically, like Leonardo da Vinci was one of the great wizards of the Renaissance time, probably the most famous one.
And we consider him a wizard?
Absolutely. No question about it.
Did he consider himself to be a wizard?
Well, you know, I think this does not appear precisely that way in his things. The problem about wizardry and being a wizard is that most of the time it's something that other people refer to you as rather than something that you call yourself, you know. It's becoming more popular now to call oneself a wizard, but until I started doing it, there weren't very many people you would find in the modern world who use that term for themselves. But we've used it for others. We've talked about computer wizards. We've talked about great scientists like Mr. Fuller or as being a wizard, you know. I mean, the word has been used for people who are known for their mastery of esoteric knowledge and lore and things like that. And there are many, many examples throughout history, you know.
Or that can be the use of the term can also be applied to people like the Wizard of Oz, which actually implies somebody who gives the appearance of ability who doesn't really actually have it.
Well, true, but the point about the Wizard of Oz story was that he was merely pretending to be a wizard, and he wasn't really a wizard.
Okay.
The question is, what is really a wizard? You know, is somebody who really actually has the goods, you know, who really does know this stuff, you know? And so he was, the point about him is he was being a fake wizard, you know?
Okay. Well, fair enough on that. Now, but let me ask you, whenever I see images of wizards, such as yourself, invariably they are pictured with a staff, with a wizard staff. Is it true that the magic is in the staff?
Well, the magic is in the wizard, is in their heart. But the staff is associated with the wizard in, and it's sort of almost a part of the wizard in a sense. You know, the staff is generally made at the same height as the wizard, and it's something that they can be used to direct the power energy, or to be a repository of a power energy, like a battery, you know, might be seen. It commands respect. It's a badge of office. It's like the scepter of a, you know, of a king, kind of a thing. You know, there are certain instruments and badges of office and funny hats that are worn by people. You know, the bishop's crozier, you know, of a Catholic bishop, for example, is essentially a wizard staff. You know, the pointy hats that you find in all of the wizard things from the dawn of time on up is a part of all this. So these things are part of what the full image, you know, conveys that, you know, and it's all a part of it in that sense. Yeah, but they are directed. The staff is directed. Power, and it is associated with, in some sense, it's hard to define. It is the wizard, you know. It's the part of him that you can stay. I have stood my staff in the middle of a field, you know, and come back to it an hour later because it has a pointy end that can stick it in the ground, you know. And everybody knows that that's my place, you know. Is there?
Well,
you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I like that as sort of an avatar, then,
yes.
If you will, of your
exactly
power,
like,
of who you are.
Exactly, like we use those avatars online. It's that kind of a thing. It projects that. And they're very individual. Each staff is unique and individual. No two are alike, you know.
When does wizardry become sorcery?
Ah, that's a very good question. Well, sorcery, which is another term, other terms for sorcery are black magic and low magic. And these are, practical magic is another one, actually. These tend to be forms of magic that are used specifically to have a physical effect in the world and on other people. And mostly these are methods of control of some sort. And sorcery is understood as one of those types of skills to be developed by almost anybody studying magic. It includes, things like a voodoo doll is a classic example. You know, I mean, you put that in parentheses, you know, but of that kind of a thing where you create an image and you do something to it. Sympathetic magic is the type of magic that's involved there, where you create something that represents another thing, and then what you do to this thing affects the other. That's the basic principle behind all of this. But somebody to claim the title of a sorcerer, or to be called a sorcerer as opposed to a wizard, is generally a very negative connotation. It implies somebody whose purpose is not to serve, but to be served. A sorcerer, a wizard wishes to serve, a sorcerer wishes to rule. And that is a major distinction that has been made throughout history, really. And so you can often look at people who have claimed these powers or had these desires, and you can see the difference between, say, Gandalf and Saruman, you know, the wizard and the sorcerer, or between Dumbledore and Voldemort in the Harry Potter series. You have the wizard and the sorcerer. You know.
So are all sorcerers your natural enemy?
In a sense, yes. There is an opposition between the two. Most people further along the line understand that a balance is necessary, and so learning the dark arts is a part of the study of wizardry. It's going over to the dark side completely is where it gets into the enemy thing, the Obi-Wan Kenobi versus Darth Vader kind of a thing, you know. And so, in a sense, that's true, yes. The natural enemy of wizards is sorcerers, but it's not always that clear-cut. I've known some sorcerers that I have great respect for and that we get along with an understanding, all right, you know. But we don't mess with each other in that sense, you know.
Well, who would win?
Well, I would like to feel that the wizard always is going to win over the sorcerer, primarily because the wizard has an ability the sorcerer doesn't have, which is to garner the affection and loyalty and love of others. This is the thing that sorcerers tend to lose track of completely, is that they base their power on fear, whereas wizards base their power on love and affection, and that's a very powerful thing. There's nothing more powerful than that.
Well, I love that thought, but I mean, it comes right down to it then. If you're teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts at the Gray School of Wizardry, and dark arts is defined by that magic which is practiced by sorcerers, then wouldn't you like to see the elimination of all sorcery from the planet? If we have to defend against it, shouldn't it not exist?
Well, the trick is the defense against it. It often uses it as well. The color of dark arts is black, and the defenses against it are also of the same color. For example, you learn in the defense, you learn how to create shields and blocks and wards and protections and all kinds of things. These are forms of sorcery as well. They're just used for a different purpose. It's like using nuclear power to do positive things, presuming that might be possible, as opposed to, you know, destruction. You know, the power is often felt by people who really understand it. They often say, well, it's just like, you know, electricity or power or any, or like fire. Fire is a great example. That was our first magic, is fire. And it can be used to be destructive or it can be used in totally positive ways. So to understand the use of sorcery and to guard against it is like being understanding the use of fire and still being able to protect yourself from having your house burned down.
You know, I have to be honest with you, say I don't see the comparison in the same way. I think what you're talking about is defense against the dark arts should be more like defense against, not against fire, but defense against fire bugs. You're talking about people who intentionally are going to misuse it.
Right.
And so it's different to me than just saying it's fire, because that would be like neutral. I think the way you describe it, especially on your website, the Department of Dark Arts in the Gray School of Wizardry is a community of teaching wizards dedicated to providing the apprentice with the highest quality education in occult knowledge and appropriate to their level of development. And then you go on to talk about defending, you know, the students learning to defend against low magic. And then it also talks here about the children of the night, such as demons, ghosts, vampires, and werewolves. We're putting sorcerers in a pretty dark category, aren't we?
Yes. Well, that's true. And those who identify as sorcerers tend to be in a pretty dark category. But in order to deal with these things, one really has to understand them, too.
Yeah.
It's all part of the same category. The use of that kind of magics is all associated. I'm on very good terms, and I found it's rather surprising to be so, actually, with a number of vampires who I've come to know over the years.
Teach a class on fighting against them.
We do, because they can also be extremely dangerous. All are ethical, and it has a lot to do with the ethics. There are ethical vampires, very ethical, and they only, they only take from people who voluntarily are donors.
Then they're not taking.
Well, no, but they do need to have blood,
right,
or energy to live. You know, it's just the way it is with them.
I guess what I'm getting at here is it seems like you're kind of having it both ways, and I'm just looking at the school and I'm trying to understand it, and it just seems like sorcerers equal not good. If they're a good sorcerer, then they're a wizard, not a sorcerer anymore. If they're not practicing controlling low magic that attempts to, you know, manipulate others for their own selfish purposes or for them to rule, if they're not doing that, then they're a wizard. If they are doing that, then they're a sorcerer.
That's pretty much it.
Okay.
And the two terms have blended back and forth over the time, too. I mean, Dumbledore is referred to as a sorcerer at times in the Harry Potter stories, even though it's, you know, not quite in the same sense that Voldemort is, you know. And Saruman is called a wizard in The Lord of the Rings, you know. So the terms are not that hard and fast exactly. It really has more to do with where people put their primary identification. And it has a lot to do with the people who feel... See, there's a difficulty that often comes with people who know a lot and have a lot of ability is that many of them get to feel that, well, since they know so much, they ought to be ruling the world, you know?
Right. Yep.
And, you know, that's a very dangerous place to go, you know, which is why it has been best and traditional for wizards to not seek positions of becoming, you know, the rulers and kings and such, but they've often been advisors and counselors for kings historically, as well as in stories, you know.
Of the famous world leaders who have attempted to control or rule over millions against their will, have any of them, Hitler, you know, Stalin, you read the list down, have any of them been sorcerers?
Well, Hitler certainly was. He was really interested in this stuff, and he studied magic and utilized it as much as he could. The Wilhelmsburg Castle that had a special chamber for doing sorcerous magic, the Order of the Trapezoid was something he considered. There's a whole book called Morning of the Magicians that discusses this kind of thing. So, in fact, Hitler was so much into this that the British intelligence had to hire astrologers, their own sort of wizards, to be able to get a handle on what he was going to do by studying the same stuff he would be studying to give them a grip on it. Noriega of Panama was also a sorcerer, and he did some pretty, you know, nasty stuff. One could make a case that the many people that that Hitler sent to their deaths was a kind of an act of black magic to garner power to himself. And certainly Noriega specifically utilized the magic of some of the Caribbean magical traditions to try to gain power.
Have any of our U.S. presidents been sorcerers or wizards?
None that I could say. The closest one might come to that was good old Benjamin Franklin, who, of course, was not a U.S. president, but
right.
He places fit that category. He's the only one on the dollar, on a $5 bill on our money who wasn't actually a president, you know.
Actually, there's two of them, that's interesting. Well, he's, I think Franklin's on isn't he on the 100? Isn't that what he's on? Isn't it? Lincoln's on the
right.
5.
That's right.
But he was an alchemist, and that's different than being a wizard per se. I secretly overlap, but they would still be different. Who's the most famous American that was also a wizard in your knowledge?
Well, let me see.
Excuse me.
The famous part is the tricky part.
Anybody that you kind of like how Masons know, like who the Masons were.
Right.
Do wizards know who the wizards are?
Well, yes, we do. I think Buckminster Fuller may be one of the most famous.
Get out!
Wizards. Yeah, he was very.
Really?
Yep, he was. There was the guy who founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, Jack Parsons, was a very, very substantial and well-known and highly regarded wizard. And he was unfortunately killed in an explosion in the laboratory that many people think was not an accident.
But set by whom? A trap of sorcerers?
Probably not. He had enemies that were more associated with government than anything else.
Hang on for a second. Think on that. We'll come back to it. Okay. Famous Americans who were also wizards, and for that matter, we can branch it out to people in history that you would never have suspected that are wizards. A wizard's bestiary, Oberon Zell Ravenheart, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with Oberon Zell Ravenheart, a wizard and the headmaster at the Gray School of Wizardry, an online Wizarding Academy, and we're not yet quite ready to take your phone calls, but I'll be curious to see what you do with Oberon coming up next hour. Just started to learn a little bit more about famous wizards that you may not have known about. Oberon Zell Ravenheart claiming Buckminster Fuller was a wizard. That's how he was able to come up with the geodesic dome and some of his other inventions, which were way ahead of their time. Also, Leonardo da Vinci, what about you? We'll find out what you think of all this coming up next hour. But more first from Oberon next on what other famous people, both in America and around the world, other famous people that were actually wizards. And then we'll continue to explore the dark arts a little bit, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Oberon, I should just probably mention here, too, I think it's come up before on Coast to Coast. I had the opportunity, the rare opportunity to meet Buckminster Fuller, the designer and visionary, when I was a kid. And I gave him a tour of my school when I was about 12 years old.
That's
it was very cool.
Yeah.
All right, so who else are wizards?
Well, I think my own favorite wizard is one who ought to have been a lot more famous than he is, which is Nikola Tesla, who at the beginning of the 20th century was the person who developed some really astonishing powering devices, electrical things. He was way ahead of things. He envisioned systems of deriving energy from the earth and the currents in the earth and magnetism and all kinds of things, and made many, many patents. And his work was all confiscated by the government, and much of his stuff was destroyed. And his great opponent was another person who was very well known as a wizard, referred to and still referred to in his biographical literature as a wizard, and that was Thomas Edison. And, you know, if you read any of his stuff about him, that was a name that was commonly given to him. Now, those two were in constant competition, and some of it was not entirely ethical, I think, on Edison's part. Edison eventually prevailed, but I think that Tesla was by far the more brilliant of them.
Was it sort of a tri-wizard tournament between Edison and Tesla?
Yeah, pretty much. More like a die-wizard tournament.
Okay.
Yeah, the two of them were great rivals throughout their life, and it was pretty devastating to Tesla. As I said, he was imprisoned and all sorts of awful things happened to him, but he was truly by far the more brilliant of the two in many ways, and the world might have been very different had his work prevailed.
You know, knowing a little bit about the temperament of Thomas Alva Edison, yeah. I wouldn't think his lifestyle or his personality type would fit into the wizarding world very well.
Well, they wouldn't, and I wouldn't. I would not think of him that way myself. Really,
I'm
not listening. But he was called that by many people, and that's often the way it comes down. Is that somebody may not necessarily claim the title themselves, but people will refer to them that way. And so it's sometimes hard to sort it out a little bit. Historically, there's a lot more clear-cut examples and people who are widely regarded as wizards, and many of them did, in fact, claim this. And for example, Isaac Newton is a great example and often cited in books on wizardry. And he was regarded as both the first scientist and one of the great wizards as well. And he himself fully embraced all of these elements. He embraced the new science as well as the older arcane wizardry of alchemy and all the rest of the such. There was the separation we think of now today between magic and science, and between wizards and scientists, is one that did not really exist until the 1600s. And in the 1660s, the founding of the Royal Academy of Science, the first purpose of that really was to separate out the real from the unreal, as it were, you know. And so a lot of things got thrown out with the bathwater. They kept astronomy and got rid of astrology, you know, and it kept chemistry but got rid of alchemy, and it kept, you know, it went on that way down the line with things. So lots of things were consigned to the ash bin of history that may not really have deserved it, you know. But it was very important at the time to establish what was real and what wasn't real. But those distinctions have shifted over time. I had a set of encyclopedias of science, for example, that were published at the turn of the 20th century, and they included all kinds of things in the official scientific field that in modern science rejects, such as parapsychology, for instance, was considered quite scientific in those days. And now it's the scientists don't consider it so, you know.
You mentioned that Hitler may have been a sorcerer, a Noriega, for that matter, too, and yeah. And that there was, defense against the dark arts used with them. As I'm looking at the defense against the dark arts classes that you offer at your wizarding school, it says here demons and ghosts. Where do demons come from?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, really. Demons is... it's an ancient Greek term. The original was daemons, D-A-E, but pronounced as we would still pronounce demons. And it meant almost like an alter ego or a something that was a part of you, in a sense, that inspired you or informed you, that had power. It's what we might call, like your guardian angel or the image that Disney popularized of having a little angel on one shoulder and a little devil on the other shoulder.
See, the way you were describing it, it sounded more like the Jungian shadow self to me.
Very much, yes.
Okay, well, I would put that different than the duality of the devil-angel thing. I would think the whole shadow self concept is that there's a part of us that we project outside of ourselves that contain all the things that we wish we could be or all the things that we're painfully aware that we are.
Very good. Yes, that is a really apt description, really, of what the demon concept has been through much of history. It became demonized, as it were, really, when the church decided that it didn't want to have people having access to anything that didn't come from the official sources, you know. So the whole realm and study of demons and demonology and all the stuff involving that, which was really an early version of what a lot of the Jungian work was about, using different metaphors and terminology, of course.
Then what are you fighting when you fight demons in defense against the dark arts?
Well, you're usually fighting things that other people are sending, ill will and ill intentions. The thing is that we have an enormous amount of power and influence over our own selves and our lives and what we choose to do and our actions. And I often say, how I treat you is up to me, but how you treat me is up to you, you know? Or actually the other way around. It's one of those great truths in which the opposite is also true. So really what you're fighting with, in a sense, is all the things that would attempt to subvert your will and to control you and to destroy you, to sap your energy. There are many things. In the modern world, many people go through lives constantly feeling that they are being victimized or besieged or attacked or, in general, just under siege. Some vary quite specifically, such as people who are abused in abusive situations and relationships, and there's really quite a lot of that. People, this may be on an individual level, like, women in abusive relationships, or it may be on a general level, like entire populations that are subject of persecution or victimization, like the Jews were in Germany and like the blacks were in the United States or the Indians. Many people have, it's entire categories of people have been subjected to persecution. So all of these are the kind of things that you want to be able to defend yourself against. Much of the Jewish magic of the Kabbalah and back in the Middle Ages, many of the great wizards were Jewish because of the studies of this, were all designed to protect them against persecution from their enemies, you know, which had been going on for a very long time.
Very interesting. Is for those wizards that abuse their powers and their privileges, is there a type of guild or council which will come in to handle when a wizard is out of line?
Yes, there is. There are in the magical communities many, many recognized elders, and when there is a situation where somebody has evidently been abusing their powers, their councils are convened to address this and to deal with this. I have been a part of such myself on several occasions. Fortunately, in the magical community, this is rare. It's very rare because people generally learn pretty early on not to do that. There's a principle in magic that is a reciprocity principle. It says that whatever you put out returns to you, often multiplied threefold, although that threefold thing is kind of thrown in as a, you know, as a cautionary, you know, it's not a really accurate statement precisely. But it's the action-reaction principle of thermodynamics applied to magic here, you know. So what goes around comes around.
And so what do you do when you sanction a wizard? How is a wizard punished for excesses?
Well, punishment is not exactly how we handle things. The whole concept of punishment is something that we're trying to get away from, the idea of retribution, retaliation, punishment. Generally, what happens in a situation like this is that they are simply stopped. You know, the word goes out. They are told that they may not take in students. The people are told about them. They're ostracized from the community. They don't, you know, they're not allowed to attend gatherings and things anymore. If people see that they are advertising for students or anything like that, they are, you know, that's stopped.
Can you give me an example of a wizard that had to be stopped without giving a name?
Yeah. Okay, I can. Without giving a name, there was an individual who was quite prominent in a particular area of the country at one time, and some of his students started letting people know that he had been requiring them to engage sexually with him at a certain point of initiatory stuff. And this has all been very secretive, so that they had been forbidden from telling anyone. But eventually the word got out because, you know, people, you know, would tell somebody they were very close to, or, yeah, because they were quite upset and distraught about this thing. And this was definitely an abuse of power and influence, for certain, to be victimizing students who were trusting of this sort of thing. And a large gathering of elders of the whole area of the country was convened, and he was hauled up on the carpet for this and totally banned from any work for a very, very long time, for many years. His reputation is still, you know, basically in the mud, and his name has become associated with somebody that you wouldn't want to have anything to do with. It's quite a serious situation to be in that position. As I say, it's been very rare. There really have been very, very few examples of such people.
Right. But in this case, then, is he monitored for being a bad wizard? I mean, do people keep track of him to make sure that he doesn't take in more students or repeat the same crimes against wizardry?
Yes, they do. They do. People watch him pretty carefully.
Are there dementors like there are in Harry Potter?
No, we don't have creatures like that that are assigned to people. That's not really necessary. There is the community watches them. There is a huge community. The magical community is just enormous, and we're everywhere. And, you know, we can pretty easily recognize each other, but most people are not known to anyone else unless they step out and reveal themselves. So, you know, people really never quite know who might be watching them, you know, especially if they are themselves ostracized from the community.
Now, are any of our current candidates running for president either a witch, a warlock, a wizard, or in the case of Dennis Kucinich, perhaps an elf?
That's good. Well, no, I can't say that any are. I think we could probably use a bit more wisdom in national politics. And it would be very nice if we would be able to have wizards in the future.
When was the last time a ruler actually had a wizard as a grand counselor?
Well, Queen Elizabeth I was certainly famous for John Dee, who was her counselor and wizard advisor. And
was he an astrologer or was he a wizard?
Well, he was both. He was an astrologer. That was how he earned his living. But
that's what I thought he was. Yeah,
yeah. He was also a
wizard.
He wrote whole books on this. Oh yeah, he wrote entire books on wizardry. He developed entire systems of magic called the Enochian systems, inscribed you know, communications from spirit beings that he called angels and such. And it's quite a story. John Dee is quite...
What year was that?
Well, that was in the around 1500 type of era. Okay. Let's see.
And how did the people deal with the idea of having a wizard in a very superstitious age, I might add? Yeah. Was he well received? Was he a well known wizard advising the queen?
He was. And well, the thing was that Elizabeth was so highly regarded in her time. Once they kind of got some of her enemies out of the way. That people just kind of went along with whatever she did, you know.
Should a wizard participate in the in a murder of a political or royal rival?
Well, I don't think that should is exactly the right thing to say. I think that I would not recommend that kind of thing. But when my counsel and say that, look, so-and-so you think you trust is actually your enemy, you know, and you should have to figure out how to deal with that. In the world of politics of that era, that didn't leave a lot of options often. You know, certainly if Elizabeth hadn't gotten rid of some of her enemies, but she didn't do it herself. It was her, people close to her that looked out for her interests and took out some of her enemies. But had they not, she would have probably been assassinated early on, and we would not have had the great, glorious golden age we had with her.
Does part of the credit to that go to her protective wizard?
Well, I think so. I'm not so much for that part of it. It's more for the choices that she had to make. Dee was her astrologer and advisor and consultant, and so she went to him when she felt that she needed counsel on in places where she wasn't quite sure what path to take and what decisions to make. So that's really a large part of the role of a wizard. I practice this kind of work myself. I do divinations and readings and such for people. They come to me and they're at a crisis in their life and they need to know where to go with it. And that's part of the wizard's work. It's part of the magic. And it takes a lot of training. I have training both in the divinatory arts, in reading and psychic work, as well as in the field of psychology and psychotherapy and counseling. You know, all of this stuff runs together there, and I use all of it.
No, it's then that brings me back to a conversation we started with a little while ago. You mentioned your ability to be psychic or intuitive. You mentioned slight telekinesis ability, being able to move things like fire or smoke just using your mind. What else can you do that I can't do?
Well, let's see. I can talk to snakes. In the Harry Potter stories, it would be called a parcel mouth. I have an ability to communicate with a number of animals. I've spent much of my life with animals, wild animals of all kinds, as well as normally domesticated animals.
And what do snakes have to say?
Well, not much, actually. It's more being able to see through them, and they have a very, very small brain and very little memory, but they are totally empathic. They have no hearing. They have no ears at all, and so they're incredibly receptive to feelings and communication. So it's not so much a matter of what they have to say as a matter of you connecting with them and being able to influence them and to see through their eyes and such, which I have been able to do to a remarkable degree. There's a whole story about that I could go on with if you wish. But
I do. I do wish that, and I hope I'm going to make you do that coming up in our last hour together. But okay. Let's go ahead and give out the phone numbers, too, coming up after the top of the hour, so that you can talk with Oberon Zell Ravenheart. He's the headmaster of the Gray School of Wizardry and the co-author of A Wizard's Bestiary. You can find out more about him by linking up at coasttocoastam.com. I'll be real curious to see where the questions go with this. Let's keep them respectful, too, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.